Welcome to our podcast.
If you enjoy this segment, we encourage you to check out the others. Also, if you're new to HedgEye, you qualify for a special discount on one of our HedgEye investing products. Email customer service director Matt Moran at mmoran@hedgeye.com. That's mmoran@hedgeye.com.
Hi, I'm Keith McCullen. Welcome back. The one and only Grant Williams. Now there are gentlemen in this business, and then there's Grant Williams. Welcome.
Mate, hi. It's great to be here. It was good to chat you, Keith.
You know, if I could only be, well, maybe I will be. Maybe that's a goal. As I go further down the path, if I could have a little bit more gravitas and be a little bit more polite, I think I can find my way to be a little bit more like you. Thanks again for making the time. You were actually teed up by Mike Green. He was complimenting your podcast. Congratulations on how well that's gone. We get a lot of people, HedgEye Nation or people following us on Twitter that are constantly saying, "Hey, have you heard about this guy?" I'm like, I heard about this guy. This is the second time we were going to have him at the investing summit. So welcome.
Well, that's very kind. Thanks for having me. Not that there's much to talk about, but I'm sure we'll find some way to bumble through the next 45 minutes or so.
Well, let's start with something that maybe an Irish-Canadian, and I guess you're born in the UK, right?
Yeah, a displaced half-Brit, half-Aussie, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Well, so it's maybe a topic we'll be criticized for broaching, which is the American exceptionalism and where we are. Currently, I've often described this year as uniquely American problems in terms of portfolio manager positioning, FOMO. There's a whole host of issues that are uniquely American that you don't quite find if you're analyzing all of global macro, particularly even equity markets. It's an American thing. And when I was reading some of your notes, I was like, wow, this guy. I think at least partly agrees with that. In fact, you might have a more well-rounded thought process on what's actually going on out there.
Well, it's funny. For me personally, I grew up in a time when America was still very much that shining city on a hill. And as a young kid in England, I was fascinated by America. I was just absolutely in awe of the place. And I first came here to the United States when I was about, 11 years old, and I went to Detroit of all places because my father was working for a company that had a an annual general meeting there. And so there I was, this little kid standing at the bottom of these enormous skyscrapers, and it looked like the set of Blade Runner to me. And I, from that day to this, I've been in love with the place. And so it's incredibly sad for me to see what's happening in the United States. And I don't that mean a knock on the U.S. in particular, because I think we're seeing the same kind of fracturing everywhere. It just so happens that the United States is so important has been so important for the tone of the world. And so when that tone has been positive, as it was, for much of the last 50 years, it's an incredible tailwind. But when you start to see the kind of toxicity levels rising in the U.S., that becomes a headwind for the rest of the world, which is kind of a lot of places that take their cue from that. So, when I look at it, that the big thing that's lost has been the ability to have civil disagreement, civil discourse. And I just think without that, it becomes very difficult to come together and discuss problems and find solutions in a bipartisan way. And right now, the problems that the world face are transcend politics by some distance. And so, unless we find a way back to the middle, and I think social media has a lot to answer to in terms of creating these echo chambers which just amplify the bad feeling on both sides, unless we can find a way to come together and discuss things that we're not comfortable with and we don't necessarily agree with in a respectful way in a search of answers, and accept that there are differences of opinions out there. And this woke cancel culture, unfortunately, well-intentioned though it may be, amplifies that, and we've reached this point where if you disagree with the masses, you are ostracized and cancelled and cast out, and that's just an incredibly dangerous environment, I think, to be kind of fomenting.
Yeah, that's an understatement. I mean, and thanks for sharing that story, that personal journey. I had the same thing, and I that resonates with me. I mean, I came here in the mid 1990s. I landed in New Haven, Connecticut, and I thought that was the industrial mecca of the world.
Right.
Like, because I'm coming from a small town in northern Ontario in Canada. And I quite literally, I'm serious about that. And when I was able to get an internship on Wall Street in the late 90s, it was so exciting, and it was all yeah. about American capitalism. And I really, you know, having now raised a firm and a family here, I mean, I really do worry. And I try to take it in a constructive way, like try to be the change. But it is increasingly hard to even say that I'm an Irish Catholic. I mean, it's crazy. Yeah. So. I don't know. I mean, I guess kind of putting it into the market, you know, into how a theme or a topic like this, and you can't quite put your finger on it, like, you know, on it precisely. Civil discourse is a good one. It's found its way into the most precious part or the heart of American capitalism, which is the stock market. Has it not?
Look, it absolutely has. And I would argue that perhaps the best place to really look at this and get a microcosm of the broader world is Bitcoin. Now, this is somewhere that both sides of that particular argument are absolutists, right? Either Bitcoin is the solution to all the world's problems, you know, Bitcoin fixes this, that, everything else, or it's a total sham and a Ponzi scheme and it's going to zero. And while either of those may still be true, because we just don't know, the likelihood is that somewhere in the middle lies the truth. And yet, you know, when you try and engage both sides on the argument, it's a really difficult thing to do. And I've tried, you know, Mike Green, talking of which, very kindly came on my podcast, and we managed to actually have a very civilized debate with a young guy called Nick Carter, who's, you know, a very, very impressive young man. Until the Bitcoin thing blew up, I wasn't aware of Nick, but he, like many others in that space, have impressed me with the quality of their thinking and the quality of their, talking about that subject. And we did manage to have a respectful discourse. Now, I don't think we changed anybody's mind, and I didn't think we were going to change anybody's mind, unfortunately. But there's this enormous chasm in Bitcoin it's the no man's land, and there's no point really venturing in there. You know, I've just shied away from it because I realized that both sides hold on to their opinions so strongly, and if you come down anywhere other than on that side, you're written off. And so I think if you're not going to enter somewhere to have a discussion and people are going to listen to you and engage and help you test your theories, you know, have fun staying poor is not an answer to genuine concerns about the viability of Bitcoin, unfortunately. So, you know, while I try and understand it better and get more comfortable with the problems I see with it, I find it increasingly hard to do unless you can do it away from the glare, you know, in private conversations with people, where you can kind of do away with this toxicity that immediately springs up the second anyone talks about it. You know, and Mike, look, Mike, God bless him, and Mike, as you know, is a very, very deep thinker. Mike doesn't shoot from the hip. He doesn't come out with half-baked ideas. And he's raised legitimate concerns, which he voiced very articulately in that conversation, in a great back and forth with Nick. But instantly afterwards, you know, the Twitter streams are filled with, you know, Mike this, Mike that, and loser, and all this kind of stuff. And I just think it's a great shame because that side of the argument is missing the opportunity to hear one of the great thinkers of his generation explain to them why he thinks they ought to reconsider. And if they listen to him, stress test his arguments and decide that he's wrong, it's a gift he's given them, you know, mm-hmm. giving them the ideas that might test their thesis. But no, it's just a pile on. And I just think it's become a waste of time to do that in public.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, going back to what I love and still love to this day about America and particularly the capital markets and Wall Street specifically, it's that it never is about what Mike Taylor has said on multiple Hedge Eye Investing Summits, and I'm sure he'll say it again when we have him on in an upcoming conversation. It's don't be right, make money. And yeah. being right politically, philosophically, evangelically, whatever it is, like for someone like me, I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. I don't want to talk to you about that. I don't give a shit about what you think. Because I don't care. Like, I don't feel anything about that anyway. Like, what I really want to do is figure out if what I'm investing in here, whether it be Bitcoin or, you know, cattle futures, you know, whether I can trust that, you know. And I think that, you know, not having a balanced conversation about anything where I'm investing money to make money, save and make money, it can't have anything other than an objective conversation. And I wonder, like, you've spent a lot of time on Wall Street. You've observed a lot of people
in their ecosystem, which is unique, right? Dirty little traders like me or whoever, you know. There's so many different ways you can make money on Wall Street without ever really being a philosopher or evangelist. This is the story of the game that we're in. So what do you think about that?
Well, look, I keep coming back to the profound change that social media has had, because you're absolutely right. But it used to be that you would make money quietly, right? You'd sit there and you'd do your thing and you'd have your positions on and you'd make your bets and you'd hedge your risk. You'd do all the things that you do now, but you did them privately. And what happens when you build this enormous public edifice around every decision, every pronouncement that people make about things, you instantly create the ability for people to misjudge what they've done on a timeline that may be completely at odds with the timeline that person is necessarily investing. So when you talk about making money, absolutely, right? But you talk about making money when you tally the final scores. And most people's final scores are very different. And so I think now if you're investing with a longer term horizon, and that is very much out of fashion these days, you know, because of the immediacy of the world around us, it's all about making money today and this week and in the last hour. And when you do that, it creates a very dangerous dynamic, because you give yourself so many more opportunities to be wrong. Mm-hmm. And that plays havoc both on your psyche if you're wrong often. And it also gives people the chance to tell you you're wrong, which they will do with great delight. And so I think understanding your own time frame is the most important thing to do. And once you do that, if you want to be public about what you do, if you want to make big bets and make sure everybody knows about them, that's fine. But make sure they understand your time frame too, because it'll help you mentally manage just your own psyche as things may go against you in the short term. You know, I recently spent some time helping a family make some really long-term decisions about some wealth. And we were talking in terms of how we'd invest that money for 100 years. And when you have a conversation like that, this is multi-generational wealth that they want to make sure is protected and preserved for generations to come. When you sit down and talk in those terms, it becomes very easy on paper and in theory at least to say, well, okay, let's say for argument's sake that inflation is the next real big problem we're going to face. When you go onto Twitter and you talk in the general population, if you call inflation and we get bond yields going down next week, you are wrong about inflation. Whereas if you're managing money for 100 years and you think, you know, over the next 10 to 20 years, I think inflation is going to be the problem we face, you can then go about trying to establish a portfolio that will help insulate you against that, knowing that, you know, if we're wrong for the next year, in a 100-year time frame, it doesn't matter. As long as we get the trend right, then over that 100-year period, we're going to perform well. So I think everybody has to understand the time frame they're looking at and realize that the shorter that time frame is, the more chance you have to be wrong. And the more public you are about that short time frame, the more chance you have for outside agents to really interfere with your own mindset, because look, we're all human and we're all fallible to that kind of input from outside agencies. So it takes a very, very single-minded mindset to get through that and be able to ignore all the slings and arrows and just focus on what they're doing if they do it in a public way. So I think understanding your own stuff and maybe being very judicious with the amount of limelight that you kind of or sunlight that you apply to your own investment technique, it makes sense for a lot of people.
Well, I mean, the limelight in many regards, or the sunlight, or the darkness that can be Twitter. If you're a one-way marketer of an asset class, like there are many on, I've had some unfortunate engagements across. You know, it just happens. I'm currently in this with gold bugs. Because I'm not a gold bug. I just want to risk manage my gold accurately.
Right.
I mean, you know, the best thing I think people can do to get better than bad at this, which a lot of people are, is to be wrong. Like, I prefer to be publicly wrong and frequently wrong, because it forces me to explain my decision-making process, explain my process in the entirety of in the singularity of my process, and improve my process so that I don't make the same mistake twice. Like, when you coach anybody, I coach you know, 13-year-old kids, 10-year-old kids. The uncoachable kid is the one with the parent who can't handle the one mistake and, moreover, makes the same one over and over again. So, again, there's a wonderful opportunity to teach in markets using these channels that it's you're going to be wrong, and we want you to be wrong. But I guess, in essence, taking this all the way around to where we started, if you're starting from a place that I can only have one position forever, long Bitcoin or it's going away, you're really not able to have that discussion. And you can't be wrong. Because if you're wrong, you're really wrong. Like, I see people on the dollar, for example. Some person's got some theory. And it's like, well, the dollar goes up and it goes down. Like, if you get the cycle right, you're going to get the dollar right. That's where we need to go here. You don't need to be permanently bearish on the dollar or permanently bullish. I mean, it's not – perma is not a position.
Yeah. Yeah. There's that old – I think it's Bob Farrell. Rosie's always reminding us it's such a great thing. Do you want to be right or do you want to make money?
Yeah.
And unfortunately today because of the amount of public attention that everything gets, everybody wants both.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, because of ego, because of hubris, because of whatever it may be, if you gave them the choice, most of them would say, oh, I want to make money. But when it comes down to it, they want to be publicly right first because of, the kudos that comes when you are, and B, the avoidance of the shame that comes when you're not. And it's a huge problem. We're all subject to the same emotions, and some of us handle it better than others. Some of us just shrug that stuff off, which is fine. But I think you're absolutely right. Until you make mistakes and learn from them, and I say this to my kids all the time, there are things that I can't teach you that you have to learn. And I will tell you, this is going to happen. Don't do that. All these things that you know as a parent. I'll tell you that so many times, but I know in my heart of hearts, these are things that you can't be taught. You have to learn them the hard way. And it's the same with investing. So listening to people talk about their mistakes, which is something that I've always focused on, during my time at Real Vision, I was so interested in people talking about their mistakes,
right,
and what they got wrong, and most importantly, what they learned from them. Because that's, to your point, that's where the real value lies. If you can avoid making one costly mistake that someone else made just by hearing them talk about it, recognizing it when it's about to happen to you, and taking the other course of action that I would imagine at the time will go against every instinct that you have, then that's incredibly valuable. And those mistakes are all out there. The pavement is littered with them. You're going to step in them every single day, and avoiding stepping in as many of them as you can will make such a difference in the long term to your mindset and your performance.
Yeah, I think that culture of learning is certainly a path that some want to be on. And look, there's a growing community of people that want that objective education, that practitioner's education in markets. I see it in my audience. The Real Vision audience has it as well. You do with your podcast. That's what people are tuning into. They're not tuning into an evangelist on a one-way marketing strategy for an asset management product. On one thing that people have struggled with, on bubbles, this U.S. stock market, and I know that you, I think you've called it a market functioning bubble. For me, my lesson, well, first of all, in the 21 years that I've done it, we've seen two epic bubbles, just using the aggregate U.S. stock market bubbles, collapse. I've fortunately not been on the wrong side of those. I don't want to make that 2 for 3. But I have learned what I didn't do on the way up in the late 1990s, because I was a newbie on Wall Street and I had no freaking idea what I was doing. But what I didn't do is make enough all the way into that final third of the move. Like, as Paul Tudor Jones would say, that's the hardest place to make money, is in the last part of the move, up or down. And this one, I've seen, there's been a chorus of bubble talk, for a long time. And yeah, on my timeline, we're getting closer to the end. But the fact of the matter is that, if you knew it was a bubble, why wouldn't you have been long it? I guess Jim Bianco and I have talked about this recently. I just want to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I think you made a great point there. In Major League Baseball, if your batting average dropped from 1,000 to 666, you're still having a hell of a year, right?
Yeah.
But in investing, if it does that, that will set you back decades.
Yeah.
And so it's the one thing that you absolutely have to avoid. And so with the bubbles, when the likes of Paul Tudor Jones and Druck and all these guys talk about that phase being the hardest to make, it is. It's the easiest and the hardest to make money. It's the easiest to make it, but it's the hardest to keep it.
Yeah.
And so I think for a lot of people, it's a place where you should leave it to the Tudor Joneses and the Druckenmillers to make money. Because while the potential rewards are enormous, you do run the risk of slashing your batting average by a dramatic way like that. And if you do that, you know, if the one thing you do in your entire investing career is avoid the big drawdown, you'll do absolutely fine. Over time, you will end up being very successful in your investing career. But you have to avoid those big drawdowns. And the hardest thing to do is avoid them when you get into a phase like we're in now. And nobody exhibits that better than that great Druckenmiller story that he told Ken Langone at the Lone Pine Tree Club, whatever it's called in New York. And for those who haven't heard it, you can Google it online, but I'll just give you the cliff notes on it. You know, Langone asked Druckenmiller about this famous experience he had in 2000 when he was running money for George Soros, and he watched all these young kids getting rich trading the tech bubble, and he'd sat it out saying it was a bubble. And in the end, he just couldn't help it. He just couldn't sit by and watch these guys making money day after day. And he put a bunch of Soros's money to it, and he lost $1 billion in very short order when he just caught the tail end of the market and it collapsed. And this is Stan Druckenmiller, for God's sake, right? Mm-hmm. And Ken Langone asked him a great question. He said, you know, what did you learn from that? And Druckenmiller's answer, to me, is one of the best answers to any question I've ever heard in finance. He looked him straight in the eye and he said, nothing. He said, I learned nothing because I knew I shouldn't have done it. And of course, he learned a hell of a lot, but he was right. He knew he shouldn't have got in there, but he did. And so he learned a bit about himself and he learned about human nature. But that kind of feels like where we are in the cycle now. There's all, and I'm in the middle of writing a piece about this now, and there are all kinds of signs of this speculative froth that you really do get at the end. And there's a lot of people, myself included, been talking and warning about this bubble as it's blown, and you know, a blow off top was always a possibility. But at every point along the way, people are talking about, well, the blow off top comes next, the blow off top comes next. At some point, you realize with hindsight, you were in the blow off top. And we don't know where it is, but I'll tell you what, this feels an awful lot like that final phase in 2000 on steroids now, because there are so many other asset classes getting swept up in this, and so many signs of speculative excess that we saw in pockets at the end of 2000 that we're seeing right across the investment spectrum. And so I'm not saying don't be involved and don't try to make money, but the important thing at this point is to be aware of where we are in the cycle, aware of all the signs around you that this is a real speculative mania we have now. And we could point to any one of a dozen things that are real flashing warning signs. And understand that, and also realize that not everybody who thinks they're standing by the exit and will just slip quietly out the door when the top comes is as close to the exit as they think. And so thinking about that and understanding the damage over the long term that suffering a big drawdown will make you, will cause you, is I think arguably the first lesson that you have to learn. And if you can learn it the easy way, then that's fantastic. But if you have to learn it the hard way, learn it while you're young.
Yeah, learn it while you're young. I mean, the corollary to that, if you go both ways, like I love to do, and you go long and short, is to be squeezed for that last part of the move and lose your fund, lose your firm, lose your friends. Not the friends part is the joke, but the fact of the matter is that, you know, we've seen some parts of, and I don't disagree whatsoever on the caricature of what's going on in capital markets, obviously, with everything that's been going on from Bitcoin to stocks trading at 70 times revenues or whatever it is, all the things are starting to appear, but they have appeared in a certain order. Some people have said, well, what's happened in GameStop is clearly a bubble. But to me, that's what happened after it went up. You know, yeah, clearly when it's at 450, there's something going on there that is certainly not a non-bubble. But where did it come from, Grant? It came from a bubble of perceived intellect. Like, how would you short a stock at three? Like, again, we had a full-blown model on this company. We said, hey, look, they're going to show a what we call pod one, or revenue acceleration, earnings acceleration. It's a highly shorted stock, and it's really cheap on our numbers. There was a fundamental case for that started at a much lower price. But the real bubble was in a significant amount of people in the hedge fund community that I'd say had a bubble in their perceived intellect. And that had a price. Like, so, yeah. So to me, in this day and age, given the dynamics of the machine, we know that things will go a lot higher, a lot faster, and a lot lower, a lot faster. To your point, it's markets are often, you know, elevators on the way up and windows on the way out. I get it. But this one, it wasn't born out of bubbliness. It was born out of disdain. High short interest stocks.
Yeah, look, that's true, but it very quickly turned into, and don't forget, really, when we talk about bubbles, we're talking about a behavioral aspect. That's really right. What they are. They're behavioral in nature. And so I agree with you, the genesis of it was that, but it quickly turned into, you could classify it as a bubble just by the way it traded. I think you're absolutely right about the kind of that mismatch in intellect. I think it's absolutely the case. But it comes back to disruption to me. And what happened there was a real disruption of the status quo. Now, the status quo was, we could do this. We know who all the enemies are. We know where the potential problems are going to come from. And we're comfortable that that's not the way things work on Wall Street. And we can put these bets on, even though you could make a very simple, and let's face it, a very simple case why it was a dumb thing to do to be short that stock. That's not how the way things work on Wall Street. Well, enter a bunch of people who don't work the way things work on Wall Street. They're doing their own thing. And that was all it took to disrupt Wall Street. Now, not in the way that the narrative was painted, that this was, you know, some kind of revolution and they were sticking it to the suits. That, unfortunately, that wasn't what happened. And the people who really got rich on Wall Street were the hedge funds. You know, there's a hedge fund called Cenvest, which made $700 million out of GameStop, and they sold out of their position the day Elon Musk tweeted GameStop, knowing full well the effect that would have on all the retail traders, just drive into a frenzy. They'd run the stock up, bingo, we're out. And so there was real disruption there, but not. It was a disruption of the kind of the cozy confines of Wall Street that people figured that's how it works in our little club. I don't think it ultimately changes the way the game is skewed towards the professionals. And look, I'm not defending Wall Street by any means here. God knows I've been vociferous about their problems enough times in the past. But whenever you try and play a game with professionals, you start at a disadvantage because they know how the rules are played. And by the rules, I don't mean the rules of the game. I mean the rules of the game at that level. You know, you can game referees in the English Premier League in a way you can't game them on a football field in the middle of nowhere on a Sunday morning. And so when you get on a pitch with the pros, you have to understand not the rules of the game, but how they're applied. And of course, what we saw was Wall Street protecting its own in terms of some of the trading stops and the halts that were put in place and the bailouts that were given to the likes of Melvin Capital. So you do have a disadvantage if you want to go and mix it with the big boys. You're going to get your wins like many people did. But I think if we could look at everybody who piled into GameStop, I think you would find that way more retail investors lost a lot of money than made it, and way more Wall Street firms made it as opposed to losing it, despite the narrative. And that's a great shame. And again, it comes back to the way the game is played, the way the story is disseminated afterwards. Wall Street's not going to give up this patch without a fight. And Wall Street has been making hundreds of billions of dollars by being the boss of Wall Street for 100 years. Silicon Valley is now trying to disrupt that. And this is what I wrote about in my last letter in February, that I think the story people are missing here is the real battle for power is Silicon Valley trying to disrupt Wall Street. But what right. they really want is that they want to be the new Wall Street and be the place where the money flows through, understanding full well that you want to really get rich, Keith. You set yourself at the nexus of where money meets other money, and you yep. just take a clip of that. And that, I think, is the real battle that's going on here.
Yeah, we're doing Josh Steiner's group, our financials team, Bitcoin Fully Loaded. We're endeavoring on a deep project there from a research perspective. And you've written about this topic, too. And this is, again, this you would not define this as a non-bubble. The intersection, let's just call it, between who clearly doesn't want anything to do with the establishment and certainly not Wall Street, Bitcoin or the Maxis, and Elon Musk and his stock, which is now officially intersected. Can you walk through what you see there and what the risks are you've gotten right down to the balance sheet.
No, it's a kind of singularity, I guess. I think it was. I think that moment when Tesla bought Bitcoin was to many people a convergence of things that really did signify potentially a top, and we saw that in the performance of Tesla's stock over the next 2 weeks or so. It fell 30-odd% in the next couple of weeks, and you can trace it back almost to the hour to that point in time where they bought Bitcoin. So I think what that showed me was there were a lot of people, institutional investors, or to be fair, just non-retail investors, who saw that, recognized it as a sign of some kind of excess, and decided to dump their shares. Now, since then, the stock has bounced back. We've seen all kinds of horrendous stories out on Tesla, which, as Elon has become incredibly adept at doing, have been hidden by some masterful, and you have to call it masterful, SEO targeting. You know, this whole coins, master of the coin and techno king stuff yesterday, you know, filed in an 8K, which makes Wall Street kind of shudder, but make the crypto, the Tesla cultists just wet their pants laughing, thinking how Elon's just such a funny guy and he's got no reverence for authority and all this kind of stuff. Well, there's real purpose in that sort of stuff, because what it didn't hide was, you know, another NHTSB investigation into autopilot. It hid the fact that Jerome Guillen is out at Tesla, one of the last few senior guys there. There were an awful lot of headlines underneath that were swamped by the amount of coverage that Master of the Coin and Techno King got. And look, you have to hand it to him. He's very, very good at this stuff. But if you look at the number of sales that Tesla have had, 500,000 cars, I think Volkswagen have sold 400,000 and change of their new electric EVs in the first 90 days of sales. So Tesla as a business still has an awful lot of problems. They've still got unanswered questions about their balance sheet. There are all kinds of things that traditional investors would run a mile from. And if we didn't have the kind of atmosphere in which news can be created and funneled and focused to the right audience that we had now, the problems that Tesla are facing would be receiving an awful lot more coverage. Mm-hmm. But because of social media, because of the way news dissemination works now, it's very easy to target the kind of people who would be likely to invest in Tesla with the kind of news that is wholly positive, and they wouldn't know about the fact that one of the most senior executives is mysteriously out of the company now with no real statement about it. They wouldn't know about these NHTSB and NTSA investigations going on. You wouldn't know about the autopilot deaths, which are kind of piling up these days. And so, again, right, you come back to this issue where the people who built this machine out in Silicon Valley are intersecting with real-world businesses, whether it be car manufacturing or whether it be banking and finance with the likes of Chamath, you know, coming in and with SoFi. And, you know, the hit job that Elon and Chamath did on Vlad at Robinhood, when Robinhood had those rather public problems over the GameStop fiasco, was very obvious why they were doing it. You know, Chamath just happens to about to be bringing public the biggest competitor to Robinhood. Well, guess what? He's going to get on Clubhouse and get on CNBC and trash this guy and trash his platform and talk about how evil it is, while he's about to roll out something which is identical, essentially, but you know, called social capital. So it's a lot more responsible and a lot more green. So I think the amount of power that's currently being concentrated in Silicon Valley's hands is becoming a huge problem, and it's only going to get worse in the short term. And I think if you're an investor, you have to understand the dynamics of that power nexus, because it's going to affect the way you trade, the way you invest, and the performance you get if you get on the wrong side of it. Because you can be shaking your head at any single valuation you look at. And if you look at Tesla, it's the perfect example. You cannot find a single valuation that justifies the company's share price. Not one. You can justify it by all kinds of rosy predictions, which is what, you know, Cathie Wood and Ark are doing about growth and the future and all this kind of stuff. There is not one current metric about that stock that justifies it being anywhere near where it is now. And so everything becomes about the future. And if you can sell that dream to people that the future is all that matters, the present doesn't, it changes the way people think about investing. It changes the way they think about your stock at the margin. And that works great in the up cycle. But if and when we do get to the period in time where things get rocky, and we've seen it in short bursts over the last couple of years when markets have wobbled, things get nasty very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And so, again, going back to your earlier point, which is a well-made one, you don't necessarily have to sit out this last phase, but you have to understand the potential jeopardy of being in it 5 minutes too long, and understand that the people who can navigate those periods successfully are few and far between.
Well, you can, there is a professional way of doing this, of course, is to short some things and not short everything. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the intelligentsia of the hedge fund community largely uses the indexes and ETFs as their hedge because they're shit scared of their shorts now. And if you time it right, you know, to use the dirtiest two words that my wife never hears me say because she won't listen to me talk about markets, thank God, you know, market timing. If you get that right, I mean, I've not been short Tesla up until the most recent month, and I'm short Shameth through Clover, which is, you know, talk about being a raconteur in a bubble. I mean, there's a bubble. I mean, we call it a little company in New Jersey, but whether it's that or him being the chairman of the board of a company that he sold all the stock, or you look at Opendoor, some of these business models, we've analyzed these are the bubbles within the bubbles, right? And you can be short those things without being short everything, you know, and that is how you remain solvent in a bubble. I think, you know, Shameth, you know, talk about emblems of the bubble, and I'm not trying to be personal. It's just he's an emblematic of somebody who thinks that everything else doesn't affect him. And the behavior is amazing. Yeah. It's amazing.
I agree 100%. Like, well, look how quickly that Virgin Galactic story got buried, right? it just went away. I mean, it was an extraordinary story, and he didn't comment on it. He didn't. Yeah, he put one tweet out, which was ridiculed by many, many people because it just didn't ring true. And there were plenty of people digging into the records and showing why it wasn't necessarily an accurate reflection of what actually happened. And then he just ignored it.
Yeah,
it went away.
And when you get down to the selling of a narrative, and this gets back to the evangelists, the selling of the narrative that this is for the social good. Have you been to San Francisco, California lately? Downtown? You
know, no, not downtown. No.
When it's dark? Not good. Not good, Silicon Valley czars of social good. Not good. Not good at all. It's actually dangerous. And, you know, this is the history of the world, you know, where you concentrate a certain amount of power, both in terms of capital, but the media. And I think that they have basically made the CNBCs of the world hostage to having access to them. Yeah. And that's why these stories get buried. I mean, Clover is a very simple story. It just went from $17 to $8. That's one way to be short a bubble, you know? Yeah. And, you know, we're not going to talk about the Clover quarter or what the guy did when he was posing with his shirt off, you know, on Twitter or by his private jet. We just don't, let's just not highlight that today. Let's talk about something else.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think you bring up a great point, that the kind of co-option of traditional media is a very important part of this. I've lost count of how many times I've seen Jim Cramer tweeting out about Tesla and how visionary it is, when Cramer's background would suggest that he, like anyone else who understands how to value companies, must be looking at the thing like everyone else who's been on Wall Street for that amount of time and going, this is ridiculous. He knows this is narrative driven. He knows that being pro-Tesla will get him an awful lot of viewers and a lot of kudos and all the right people following. He's doing it. It's a very cynical thing to do, I think. But that's where we are. People are willing to be cynical in the pursuit of the ends. We live in a very Machiavellian world, and that's something that we all have to factor into our decision-making and our kind of handicapping of the forces that we're arrayed against every single day. And it's exhausting, frankly.
Well, it's exhausting, but it's worth the fight.
Like, yeah, absolutely.
And I want to get into the questions that people have for us with the time that we have left. But it's worth being in the fight. Like, I've always, and I think this was the original, and I'm assuming the vision associated with Real Vision, and certainly is with Hedge Eye, the eye on the Hedge Eye, transparency, accountability, and trust. Like, I have to, as an independent research person, I only care about finding the truth. I don't care about your bloody narrative. If it's not true, I'm going to tell you that. And if it's true, then we're going to say that. So I think it's worth the fight. And I think that it's interesting to see, going full circle on this discussion, back to this uniquely American problem, that this is really only in America. You do not see, we're long Porsche, the best way to be long Volkswagen, which you mentioned, which, by the way, has a lot of EV, if that's what you really want. Yeah. And they're really nice cars. So we own Porsche. It's up the world today because, you know, they, of course, it's a way to play it, the stub. But, this is not the story that Wall Street wants to talk about. We want to talk about the Tesla, the Shamath, you know, that thing. And if you look around the rest of the world, you know, what's happening in the German stock market today has nothing to do with any of this uniquely American social media problem.
No, it's a great point, Keith. You know, when I talk to friends in Europe, I had a long conversation with Tony Deaton recently on my podcast. And, you know, talking to Tony about this stuff, he's just bewildered by it. Because in Europe, you just don't get the same kind of speculative frenzy. Yes, you see it in pockets and you see bits and pieces of it. And the SPAC frenzy bleeds over. And we saw a similar kind of Reddit phenomenon happen in the UK. And my fellow citizens of the UK are inveterate gamblers to a man. So it's hardly surprising.
Yeah, and I'm not saying it's not happening there. I'm just saying
pimples. But your point, I absolutely agree with you. It's not the only thing that anyone cares about. It's a peripheral story. And in the middle of it all, there are people investing in ideas, and there are people investing in the future, but they're doing it quite. They're not investing in a future that's being decided and defined for them by the people trying to build and sell them that future through their media arms. And that's a very dangerous thing to kind of construct around ourselves, is to have the media and the way we now consume our news, our information, built and brought to us by people who are desperately trying to insert themselves into the faucet of where the money comes out. It's a really dangerous situation, and I suspect it's going to get a lot more dangerous before anything's done about it, because of course that same group are as keen to co-opt politicians as they are the financial markets, and nobody needs money as consistently or in such great amounts as a politician. So you've got a fantastic group of people there who, you know, are always going to want to have their faces in the trough. So things are very, very precarious right now in many, many ways. And I think as long as markets are going up, that's great, but you really do need to be aware outside markets just how precarious things are, because I think it's worse than most people really understand.
Oh, and again, if you want to see that, get a plane ticket or drive there and go to San Francisco, California is turning into the armpit of America right now. And that's where all the money is. That's where all the power is, incrementally. I'm not saying all. I should stop using some of these words. One of the first questions we have has to do with maybe a way to answer this. I know that you have had long time had a relationship with Neil Howe, our demographer, and this question actually found its way as number one. I didn't vote it up number one. I think the people watching this did, and the question has to do with the fourth turn. And Grant, you've done extensive and this question's from Tony from Seaside Heights. Grant, you've done extensive research on Hedgeye's Neil Howe and the thesis on the fourth turning. Do you see and believe that 2020 is simply the beginning of generational shifts, or have we already weathered the storm?
Look, I'd love to think we'd weathered the storm, but I don't think
like
we have.
Sounds like we're right in it.
Yeah, well, wouldn't that be great? But I think if you sit and think about what that generational storm encompasses, it encompasses a transfer of power, and it encompasses a transfer of wealth. Mm-hmm. And while we may be starting to see that now, We're nowhere near the point where power or wealth have been transferred. And that's really ultimately, I think, where this ends is in a transference of wealth and a transference of power. Now, you can transfer the wealth in a couple of ways. You can take it from the people who have it and distribute it again to the people who don't. And you'd probably do that via all kinds of wealth taxes and one-off taxes and trying to level the playing field that way. Or you can make wealthy people much poorer and bring them down to the levels of the people who've been struggling, because when that happens, then the standard of living falls for everybody. Things have to get cheaper and more people can afford them. In terms of power, we're not seeing yet a raft of millennial politicians being elected in midterms. Now, I would suspect that the next midterms in a couple of years' time, we will see that start to happen. And that is the thing that I'm looking for. If we start to get late 30s, early 40s senators being elected in their droves, then suddenly you have a mechanism by which the disenfranchised generation, the millennials, who are at a disadvantage in terms of the power construct, can start to make a difference at a policy level and can start to challenge the boomers who obviously have a firm grip on the reins of power. Gen Xers like me are just caught in the middle and forgotten about, as we have been our entire lives. But that, I think, is going to be the real sign where the power shifts, when you start to see AOC not looking like an outlier on the Hill, but surrounded by people who look like her, a similar age, similar demographics, who are energized by similar issues, and yet now they don't just have one vote, they have 10, and they have 20, and they have 30. And when that happens, I think you're going to start to see some real change made, and it's going to be very bad for boomers by design, and it's going to be very good for millennials. And that's, I think, where the power shifts. Now, whether that happens peacefully at the ballot box, or whether the frustration and the ennui gets so bad between now and then that it happens on the streets is anyone's guess. But whereas 10 years ago you could say the chance of it happening on the streets was as close to zero as for you not to have to worry about it, I don't think you can say that anymore. I don't think you can say that this generation will quietly wait until it's their turn for power, because the disparity between the two is so egregious now that the anger is rising, and the chance that they won't wait for the ballot box and they will take things into the streets, and there will be a miscalculation on behalf of those in power trying to kind of squash any violent protests, can get out of hand very quickly, as we saw, you know, last year with some of the protests after the tragic George Floyd killing.
Yeah, well, anytime it gets down to, you know, again, in that case, black versus white, or in this case over here, evangelical view A or the non-view, which is B, you know, you have that causal factoring to have something go wrong quickly.
Well, the focus has been on a horizontal divide, you know, left versus right. The truth is, this is a vertical divide. This is haves, have-nots. This is rich and poor. This is old and young. It's a very vertical divide. And if you think about what happens if you put a line down the middle of something on a horizontal scale, you have a group of people on both sides that represent both sides in a very dynamic and holistic way. When you put a line in the middle and you have people above and below it, it becomes a lot trickier, because you don't have any checking factors across a spectrum that you have on a horizontal scale. And that's what we have. You know, if you're old and you're wealthy and you're young and you're poor, it doesn't matter if you're from Asia, if you're from Europe, if you're from the US, if you're an immigrant, if you're a natural born citizen, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You're poor. And that becomes a problem when you're looking at a bunch of rich people who look a lot different to you and have vastly more resources than you. That's what worries me, is that this is a vertical struggle, not a horizontal one.
Yeah, and it happens everywhere in between. You know,
yeah, exactly.
You,
right.
You know, people, it gets down to one basic human trait, which is greed. You have what I want, and I'm going to do what I need to do to try to get that. And
well, you know, Keith, it's a great point, and this is something that Jeff Gundlach said to me in an interview I did with him a few years ago, and it's stuck with me ever since. You know, Jeff pointed out greed and fear, but he said, you know, there's one thing that's more powerful than both, and that's need. He said, if you need to do something, you don't have a choice,
right.
And that's where this kind of wealth divide is going. It's not necessarily greed, it's need. It's, I can't afford to live my life, and Elon Musk made another $100 billion personally during lockdown. Well, how about if we start asking Elon to give $100 billion of that back, and he's down to his last, you know, $100 billion? That's the kind of thing that I suspect at some point we'll see, and I think you can make a very easy case for why the people who have been tremendously enriched by this over the years should, if they don't want to do it voluntarily, be asked very politely to perhaps give a little bit more back.
I mean, if you have that much, you need to be asked. That's just me.
But you shouldn't. I agree.
Another topic that I haven't asked about, not shockingly, has to do with gold. Rocky, the question's from Rocky. Where do you stand with gold in the short term? Can you contrast it to the other ideas of store of value that have emerged, like crypto?
It's a great question, and I'll give Rocky an answer that will probably annoy him, but it's the genuine one that I've had the entire 20 years I've owned gold. I'm not in gold in the short term. I don't have a short-term view on gold. I have a very long-term view on gold. And that's why none of this stuff bothers me. You know, I've had gold since the early 2000s, and I've never worried about it. I've never tried to time it. I've never tried to be cute with it. I think if you are a trader of gold, it's a nightmare. It's just not something you really want to be trading, because it does trend, but it tends to not trend in a very predictable way. If you're using it to diversify, or using it as a cash reserve, or using it for all the things that I think of it as, then it's not a short-term horizon. And so, you know, I look at all the commentary, and I look at all the people confused about why gold's not doing X or Y, and why it's falling. Why is it not at 2,000 with all the money printing that's going on? Why is it? I look at it, and I'm interested in the opinions on it. But for me personally, it doesn't matter. If it falls, and I've got more cash, I'll buy some more gold just to make sure that it preserves its purchasing power. But I'm not looking to flip it at $2,000. I'm not looking to flip it at $3,000. I'm looking at some point in the future to exchange it for something I feel offers me greater value. And so I hate to disappoint you, Rocky, and I'm not trying to dodge the question, but I genuinely don't have a short-term view, because I'm not a gold trader. I'm a gold holder. Not a hodler, I would say.
That's an important differentiation. I mean, as I've said many times, I mean, the physical gold that I've ever purchased, I've never sold. Right. Whereas I actually do think that you can risk manage paper gold, which is GLD, efficiently if you're aware of the macroeconomic circumstances. In other words, if real interest rates are set to break out and nominal yields in kind, that's not going to be good for gold. So I'm going to short it in front of that. Similarly, if we come out of, you know, the third quarter of 2018, both growth and inflation are peaking, real and nominal yields are peaking, that's when you buy the shit out of it. I mean, both paper and physical. So, you know, I think that's another way to maybe give Rocky a little bit more, like, you know, and again, just define what you do. You know, everybody's got their own duration. It's fine. It's not, these aren't evangelical points. They're just points in terms of defining our own duration. Just last question, and I think this is a really interesting one. Just, I have no idea what the answer is. From Olaf Gustafson. Love your Endgame podcast, Grant. What would you say is the most unifying theme of all your guests?
I think there's two.
Really? So you have unifying themes, like things that are common. Okay.
I think there's two. Two that have certainly jumped out at me over the course of these. I think we've done 17 of these now, Bill and I. the first one is that nobody has a clue. And I think that's important. It's kind of funny, but it is important. And in fact, Mike Green, God bless him, was our third guest. And the very first thing he said was, of course, there isn't an end game. And he's absolutely right. There isn't. There's a transition from the now to the what comes next. And that's really what we're trying to figure out. And so nobody knows. Everyone's trying to figure this thing. We're all trying to figure it out, because I think it is a very important thing to try and at least take the time to try and work out not what you're certain is going to happen, but the various paths this could take, and then have a plan for the ones you think are either most likely to happen or the ones which would hurt you the most if they did happen. I think that's really what the goal should be. But the second thing, which is a little bit more granular, is inflation. It's this inflation deflation debate. Okay. And whilst we've had incredibly smart people argue both sides of that argument incredibly eloquently, it's clear to me that this is the one thing now that you have to think through, you have to have a plan for, and you have to understand what it does to your portfolio. And I've talked about this at length a lot recently. Just understanding that if we do have a return of inflation, and after all the listening and all the thinking, all the reading I've done, my base case is that we will, even though I understand the Lacy's and the Rosies of the world making incredible cases why they don't think it's a problem in our near future. And Steph Pombo, who's going to be on here tomorrow, you know, is also in the deflation camp. And I get that. But again, it comes down to time frames. So if we go back to this idea of investing over 100 years, do I want to make a 10-year bet that inflation is going to be a problem in those 10 years? And yes, I do. And when you do that, you realize that having had four decades now of inflation, five decades of deflation, sorry, consistent deflationary pressure, portfolios right across the world have naturally evolved to suit those characteristics.
Exactly.
And so there are very few people in the world a year ago who had a portfolio that would give them any kind of protection, let alone profit from an inflationary cycle, because they haven't needed that portfolio for half a century. So if you think that there's even a chance inflation comes back, then by definition, you know that your portfolio is not only not set up to profit from it, it's arguably more than likely set up to be incredibly badly damaged by it. And so for me, thinking through, okay, how are the components of my portfolio going to fare in an inflationary environment? What's my time frame? Can I be wrong in the short term? Because I totally buy that we will have another deflationary gut punch coming out. I totally get that. And I think that's the likely course of action. But do I want, if I have a 10-year view, do I want to time that and try and, you know, nip the ball off the turf at the very bottom of that deflationary gut punch? Or am I happy to start shifting the allocations in my portfolio to protect me against inflation and then maybe use any deflationary period to add to that? And I think if you look at charts of commodities, if you look at some of the value investing indices, if you look at, you know, Russell Small Cap Value, if you look at those things, you'll see that I think around the margins, there are people starting to position themselves for that kind of a long-term trend that they can ride. And they happen to be given an entry point that is better in terms of commodities versus equities than it's been in, you know, 100 years in terms of the ratio between the two. So these yeah. things don't come along very often. But again, and this brings us perfectly around to one of the early things we talked about, this idea of being wrong in the short term. If you have a long-term plan, it's okay. You can be wrong in the short term. You can be very wrong in the short term. Just don't, if your long-term plan is being proven to be wrong, then you've got a problem and you need to change it. But if you have a 10-year inflation view and you begin to put it on and we get a big deflationary spike in the next 6 months, it doesn't mean you have to throw everything out. You have to reassess it, but it may just be a great opportunity to put your position on in better size at better levels. That's all.
Yeah, that's a good way to talk multi-duration, because again, the theme number one is that nobody really knows. No. So why pretend that in 10 years you know? Again, operate on the edges of the uninformed volume, you know, sell high, buy more back lower. It's amazing that saying things like that, and there's, in all humility, I actually think it's beyond amazing, actually, at this point, that in this day and age that buy low and sell some high is a unique concept. But it's
an
something
old-fashioned one, at the very least.
I gotta keep going with it, at least. And you know, also just like to thank you again for making the time. It was a nice way to spend the early part of the afternoon having a real conversation with you.
No, Keith, I've really enjoyed it. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you. And he's Grant Williams. That's a wrap today. A lot to think about there. Lots and lots. And we'll be right back at it tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. As a reminder, new Hedgeye subscribers may qualify for a special discount on one of our Hedgeye investing products. Email customer service director Matt Moran at mmoran@hedgeye.com. That's mmoran@hedgeye.com. This content is for informational purposes and does not constitute an offer to sell or buy any investment vehicle, nor does it constitute an investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. Hedgeye believes the information sources to be reliable but is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions. The opinions expressed are those of the individual speaking. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information is protected by copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient provided access by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited and subject to the terms of service at hedgeye.com.